I'm Christopher Lydon. John Corigliano, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Music this week, has taken some of the curse out of contemporary composition. His score for the movie The Red Violin had already won an Oscar, no less, for emotionally laden tunes that had to remind you of Hollywood's favorite music man, John Williams. Yet John Corigliano was also a master of all the classical forms and settings. A decade ago, he was the first composer in 25 years to be asked to write an opera for the Met in New York. It was called The Ghosts of Versailles, and it became a hit. Corigliano's Symphony No. 1, confronting the loss and rage and personal memory of the AIDS crisis, became a popular sort of musical equivalent of the traveling AIDS quilt. This and more for a world that came to assume that today's so-called serious music was almost by definition unlistenable. The composer who insists on communicating, John Corigliano, is next, as the conversation continues. Audio streaming was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Gail Leander Public Relations, helping authors publicize their progressive books. Contact glpr at aol.com. Also from Cogito Systems Group, specializing in Java and Linux-based multi-tier application development, www.cogito.com. We're listening to the fugue movement in the string symphony that won the Pulitzer Prize this week for our guest, John Corigliano. In the tightly organized chase of musical themes that make the customary fugue, the Corigliano difference here is that the signature on each of the recurrent themes is not so much its rhythmic or melodic shape, but its tempo. Faster lines weave in and out of slower ones. Just listen. John Corigliano's handiness with all the tricks of musical language is on show in this piece. Also, his usual readiness to make statements that you can expect to hear and feel. John Corigliano grew up in music. He's the child and namesake of the late New York Philharmonic concertmaster. His mother was a concert pianist. He's been writing music since his 20s. In his early 60s now, he's done everything at least once, long forms and short, solo and symphonic pieces that have won Grammys and a Hollywood Oscar. He's not an academic exactly. He's not exactly pop. He's our guide this hour, not just to his own music, but to a place in so-called serious music that doesn't sound quite as forbidding as it used to. Our phone is 617-450-2923. Give John Corigliano a call. Is this the sort of music that our time might be remembered for? The phone's 617-450-2923. Welcome, John Corigliano, and congratulations on the prize.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You seem to carry the burden of the contemporary composer, scary title, without making it look like a backbreaker.
Well, you know, there's a whole new breed of contemporary composer. I think you are thinking of music that was really written 75 years ago and 50 years ago, because the music of the younger composers today in America is very forward-looking. It reaches out to the audiences and it tries to say something new and interesting. We're not caught in that 1950s regimen where you must write on a certain way in a certain kind of technique, and so we're free to explore all the techniques around the world.
But you've mastered a trick that a lot of the others haven't, which is they call it the most important trick of all, is to get that second performance. lot of good composers. Still waiting for the second one.
Well, I think that it is very difficult to do, because obviously the first performance of anything is an occasion, and you know, the press is interested, and people are interested for the first time. But I think that I think a lot of young composers are also getting second performances of pieces that stir up people, that get them interested in hearing it again. I mean, we have forgotten, because of the kind of romantic wash of the 19th century German kind of romanticism, we forgot that basically going to a concert is a voluntary act, and listening to music is something you have to want to do, and that an audience is under no obligation to either be there or to listen to a piece, that they have to want to. And so getting a second performance really means that you have to put enough in your first performance to make them want to hear it again, just like Beethoven did, and Bach and Brahms and Mozart and all the great composers of the past. And that first level has got to be there. It's got to be visceral. You've got to pull them in like Beethoven did. But then you have to say more than just the surface like Beethoven did. And I think that that challenge is an 18th and early 19th century challenge. And in the 20th century, the composers sort of gave that up for a while, and they started satisfying themselves and saying it is of no concern whether I am speaking to this audience. And that's a great problem, because if you're not speaking to the people in the concert hall, why should they listen?
You make a point of saying that you insist on communicating, which in a certain sense would be taken as elementary and inescapable, but you're saying it wasn't for a while.
No, it wasn't. I mean, there's no question that certain techniques that are developed, for example, organizational techniques, are such that one cannot understand them with one's ears. And I'm not just talking about the lay ear of the concertgoer, I'm talking about the trained ear. If you look at serial writing, which is an extension of 12-tone writing, and even 12-tone writing, the process is extremely intellectual, but the results are not for the ear. They are actually anti-intellectual, because you cannot hear the organization. And so one of the great paradoxes, I think, that we've been caught up with is that music that has been called intellectual has been presented to an audience that has no way of all of ascertaining that intellect or what it is doing. They simply have to like the sounds for what they are on a purely new age basis of like this sound, don't like that sound. And I think more than anything else, robbing the audience of its intellectual ability to grab something to hold on to into a piece has driven them away. It's not just an emotional world that is somewhat, shall we say, less intense or less directed towards the audience, but the intellectual world is not directed towards them at all. In fact, another Pulitzer Prize winning composer told me about 10 years ago that he considered his music to be a private communication through public means. And my answer was, why should the public listen? Because you're not speaking to them. I mean, it seems
John Corleone, you write and you talk beautifully about your own work. I wish you'd give us the short course on what we need to know, need not to know, might usefully know about the piece that won the Pulitzer, this Second Symphony, which we have on a live concert recording in-house for the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Seiji Ozawa conducting. We could just start at the first movement, if you would. It's very hushed, muted sound, but help us listen.
Well, the point of this original piece, this came from a string quartet, and the history of this is that the quartet that commissioned it, the Cleveland Quartet, announced as they commissioned it that they were going to disband a year from now, from then, and they were going to play this quartet on their final tour. And so the element of farewell, of leave-taking, became pervasive in this. And I wanted, in this case, a string orchestra to rise from nothing and become a string orchestra. And so in this case, they appeared playing what we call practice mutes. They're never played in concert halls. They're the mutes that people use when they play in hotel rooms or in the family room, not to disturb anyone, and they're very, very quiet. And all of the music in the first movement, which is quite short, is of either practice mutes or regular mutes. What you're hearing now is a build in regular mutes, but it began and ended with practice mutes, as though this primeval thing rose from silence and became what you're hearing right now, which is music, and grew into music. And now you'll hear the first melodic material coming in as almost a remembrance of early music right now. In a moment, now. And they're playing without any vibrato to give the feeling of old viols way before the Baroque period. But then, when the lower strings take this, you feel the warmth of the string orchestra coming to life for the first time, which is now. Disputes come back, and the idea of disappearing into a haze and smoke, you hear them above you. And the celli have one more utterance, and the movement fades away.
You speak of this as a translation, in effect, for full orchestra, or almost a string orchestra, essentially, of a string quartet, with obvious opportunities to thicken the harmony,
right,
and the build the dynamics of the whole piece. How did this happen? Whose idea was it? Who prompted you?
Well, it was a combination of things. Actually, the Boston Symphony wanted to commission me to write a second symphony for the 100th anniversary of Symphony Hall. And I felt that I might want to write them a shorter work, but I didn't know of a subject. I need to have an idea for another symphony, just like I did for my first, that is extremely large and epic. And I told them that I really didn't have one at the moment, but that I would think about it. And in thinking about it, I rethought of my string quartet, which is about farewell, which has this feeling to the string quartet that it does still have in the string orchestra of almost going past the bounds of the instruments. And I felt that that second idea, the idea that this is almost going past the string's endurance, like the Grosse Fuge does, for example, of Beethoven, that translated into the string orchestra would be a fantastic tension to have 50 string players pushing themselves past their limits in the building of sonority and tension. And so I told them I would do that, and I said, but I'm really not sure the shape it'll take, whether I'll do this for full orchestra, for strings and percussion, for strings alone. And they said, whatever you decide is going to be the right thing. And it was an interesting process for me, because obviously the first thought would be, well, make it for big symphony orchestra. You can get a lot more sound when you have the brass and the winds and the percussion and the strings. And the more I envisioned and sketched that out, the more I realized that, yes, I did get a lot more sound, there's no question, but what I was losing was the struggle. The struggle of the strings to be more than strings, because the brass came in and, you know, and won up the strings and made the climax work. But then again, it was an easy climax because the brass have no problem doing that. And the winds and all of that color, in a sense, was taking away the struggle and the tension. And then I thought of percussion, and I thought, you know, the strings are capable of percussive-like sounds. We can do collegno, which is the back of the bow hitting the strings. There's pizzicato sounds. There's actually striking the instruments in certain ways that don't damage the instrument but produce percussive sounds. So I said, you know, the string world really, as the very first, the beginning of the whole orchestra, was strings. And woodwinds came in as guests,
right,
you know, and then they built an orchestra. The strings have the ability, and it's the only section that does, to sound as one, because they're all shaped exactly the same, and they produce, therefore, different pitch levels of higher and lower, but they also can sound exactly like one giant string instrument playing. And then, because of all the many things that the strings can do to alter their sounds, tremolos, harmonics, ponticello, many different ways of playing, the strings can be an orchestra. Their coloristic quality is so enormous.
If I can be local, I just want to say, you know, Bostonians are very chauvinistic about, A, that hall you were writing to honor in a way, and B, the string section of the Boston Symphony. I mean, did either of those things play in the back of your head?
Yes, as a matter of fact, they did. One of the things about a great concert hall, I mean, it can take the full orchestra playing, but the reason concert halls are made of wood is the same reason that a violin and cello is made of wood, that the resonating character of a concert hall is very unique. And there's nothing that resonates better, in a sense, than the strings alone. When you add other instruments, you get all sorts of echoes and things around the hall, but the richness of the hall, the Stradivarius quality of a great hall, to me, is best shown when strings play, because you really feel every part of that hall vibrating with the stringed instruments. It's quite glorious. And again, I thought that hall, with the strings alone, will produce such a rich and beautiful sound.
Is there another section of that second symphony that would, you know, illustrate that Stradivarius hall sound? If there is, would cue it up. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, there are several sections. I'm trying to think the best one to get to because they're in the middle of movements. The problem is very often a movement will start with a single string. And
what
then
about
build
that nocturne, the central movement? Every bit of it is lyrical and...
Yeah, you could play the first few minutes of it. It starts very high. This is the third movement, and for the listening audience here, this is the central movement of the five movements of the symphony. And what it is doing is recapturing, for me, a night that I spent in a town called Fez in Morocco, in which what happens is in Morocco the muezzins sing, and they have these gorgeous. They sing these beautiful melismatic melodies, but what they really do during the day is four times a day they call people to prayer, and then the people come into the mosque, and of course you can't go there, and they hold the service. Now this is night in Morocco. It so happens that if you stay at a particular hotel and get a particular terraced window, you face over the Medina. And when you face over the Medina, at about 3 or 4 in the morning, the call begins again. But the difference here is that because it's at that hour and nobody is expected to get out of bed, get dressed, and go to the mosque, what they do is they hold the whole service on the loudspeakers and it echoes through the town of Fez. And that would be beautiful enough if it were just that single voice doing that, because it's a single male voice. But in addition to that, there are 80 or 90 other mosques that start at different times, all singing the same thing. And so we get this chorus of voices echoing around the town. And so what you're hearing now is night, really. The whole feel of, you know, the night in Morocco, the stillness, the quiet, and the purity of sound. And I think that, again, strings do this so beautifully. And you'll hear what happens is the entire movement starts, as you heard, in the high register. And the entire movement is a progression from the high register of the high violins, the lowest cellos and basses, in about 7 minutes' time. But during that 7 minutes, what happens is at a certain point you start to hear an almost human voice calling out. And then another one. And then another one. And these calls become wilder and wilder until they finally settle on a chord. And then dawn breaks and the new day has begun. See, and notice how they glissando down. This is, all the strings are slowly moving down. You'll hear the first call in just a moment. This is kind of setting up the night scene. The solo violin, three violins play after the solo cello. And they play the first call, and then it's echoed by another call. But it isn't building yet, it's just single calls. Here's the first one. Notice how it echoes through the town. Another voice. Notice when it plays, it echoes. This could be only done with a string orchestra, not a quartet. Notice the glissandos down. A new call comes now, from another place. And now another one. Now the basses will call.
John Corigliano, I hate to interrupt your thoughts on this, but I also want you to make a connection between the means, the messages, the setting, the scene, the whole feeling of the Second Symphony, and the contrast with your Symphony Number 1.
Well, that's interesting because both of them have to do with a departure. The first symphony is an agonized departure, an involuntary departure, because it was written for many friends I have lost to AIDS and a friend who I was losing at the time, who lived to hear the performance and then died a week after the premiere. This was the Chicago Symphony.
I'm going to drop, if I may, we'll pick up the first movement of Symphony Number 1 at a very central point where there's this very theatrical echo of an offstage piano playing an Albanese tango. This score better than I, but it's coming.
Yes, and the thing about that is this first movement called Of Rage and Remembrance. Here's the piano. The piano is offstage, it's not on stage. And the pianist who it was written for was sitting in the audience at the premiere, weighing about 80 pounds, and Stephen Huff, one of his great friends and concert pianist who appeared many times as soloist with the orchestra, was backstage honoring him by playing this. This is a piece he played ever since Sheldon Skolnick, ever since he was 5 years old. And so to honor him and remember him, even though he was still alive, I put this into the piece as the first movement, idea of remembrance. And now a melody comes of my own based on those three notes. And this is this was a very, 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 very sad time. We're talking about, first of all, a time in the AIDS epidemic that so many people were dying. And this pianist, Sheldon, had played as soloist with the Chicago Symphony many times. He lived in Chicago. And all the members of the orchestra had no idea he was sick for the year and a half that he stayed in his apartment. And he came out to the rehearsal of this symphony. And one by one, they realized that he was sitting in the audience, although he looked completely different. And they all got up and went over to him and hugged him. And, you know, he made his piece coming back to the orchestra and the piano, and he accepted the dedication and the piano theme and the whole idea of this piece. And I can't say that anyone dies happily, but I do know that it gave him a lot of joy. He told me that, to know that this piece will live. And it's, you see, it's a very, you're playing at this point the remembrance part, but it's also full of rage and tension because you're being, your friends are being taken away from you, but it's involuntary. Mm-hmm. They're being wrested away. It's like anyone who loses people to cancer or Alzheimer's or anything. It's the frustrations and angers and injustices that we feel, and then the reconciliation we all have to have to parting.
Could I just ask, you know your musical history very well. What does it mean to have a big piece of music so narratively kind of connected to a moment a crisis, a disease. We don't have a symphony for Alzheimer's or cancer. We don't know what those prompts were to Beethoven. People wonder about his blindness, for example, affecting his music or programming his music. But what does it add? What does it detract to put such a lot of kind of emotional, personal freight on a big piece of music?
Well, you see, I don't think it has any effect on that, because it all is how you listen to it. It's not about the writing. I mean, nobody has to know the story of Berlioz's love for this woman and his creation of the Symphonie Fantastique to lure her back to him, and the drug nightmares and the beloved and all that, to appreciate a rather fabulous five-movement piece. In the case of this symphony, the specifics are not necessary to understand the piece, because the wonderful thing about music is that it is nonverbal, that it expresses things beyond words. So that when this piece was played, for example, and I was at the performance in the Ukraine, in Kiev, where there was only a concert poster saying Symphony No. 1, there were no program notes because they never were printed up, what happened was that the audience responded hearing a tragic symphony. They wept because of the music, they felt all of that, but they had no association with AIDS. It didn't exist in their country, they never heard of it. And it was never mentioned in the symphony either, because there were no notes about it. 2 weeks later, this piece was played by the San Francisco Symphony for the second time in San Francisco, and probably everybody in that audience was listening to it as an AIDS symphony. Mm. But it really doesn't make any difference, because both of those are about the human condition. One is specific and one is general, but we are talking here about loss, the death of loved ones, coping with that, what one goes through, what it means, and how you finally reconcile it. And so those are emotions that are human emotions. They're not specific to a disease or anything else.
It's been known as the AIDS symphony. Do you welcome that?
I don't welcome it or find it negative. I didn't call it that, because it is a symphony, and it's, you know, a two-year compositional process that builds a piece of music. And I felt that specifics about that could be in the program notes, but they weren't necessary, and I wanted it to live as an abstract piece.
Before the break, excuse me, John Corleone, I want to just go back a little bit. I mean, we've heard a lot of music and a lot of your testimony about music that is accessible, deeply emotional, that does connect, that makes a point of communication. You talked about a kind of whole new breed of composers who have liberated themselves from the academic strictures of serial writing, 12 tones and all that.
May I say that I have nothing against serial writing, and I use 12-tone techniques in my own music.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I simply wanted put yourself on sort of the playing field of contemporary composers in general. I mean, I hear a lot of Copland and Barber in your work. A distinction both from the sort of neo-romantics and the academics, and also a big difference from the, I'll call them the exotics, the wonderful young composers from the third world, that Bright Sheng, for example, Tan Dun, Osvaldo Golijov, who made a huge impression here in Boston. What's your school, and what are the roots that John Corigliano is drawing on here?
Well, you could have asked me that question 30 years ago, and I think I could have answered that. I think if you look at the human brain as a kind of a computer, and think about the amount of input that today that we receive in the variety of music from the East, from the West, East Indian music, Balinese music, African music, Western concert music, popular music, theater music. We're immersed in music. We can go into a record store and buy music from anywhere, from any time.
Any sound ever recorded. Listen, ponder the thought, and we'll come back to it after the break, if you will. We'll come back also to the music of the Oscar-winning Red Violin. Our guest is John Corigliano, who won the Pulitzer Prize in Music this week. We'll be back after a short break. Audio streaming was provided by New England Streaming Media. Underwriting came from Suzanne and Bob Petrucci. And from Elsa Dorfman, Boston's Matthew Brady. Details available at elsa.photo.net. This is the violin theme in the movie The Red Violin, which won our guest John Corigliano an Oscar, Hollywood's biggest prize, 2 years ago. We're talking about contemporary music with the master, John Corigliano. John, if I may say, I mean, it's a rather marvelous company you join of Pulitzer winners. Howard Hanson, Aaron Copland, Charles Ives get it posthumously, Walter Piston, Virgil Thompson, Giancarlo Minotti, John Harbison, Gunther Schuller, Ned Roram, Bernard Rands, Donald Martino, Leon Kirshner. Always have to mention the guy who didn't get one and should have, Duke Ellington, who said the fates were being kind to him. He didn't want to be too famous too young. What about that company?
Oh, I think that's why the Pulitzer means so much to a composer. In fact, people have said, you know, said, how do you compare getting the Oscar to the Pulitzer? And it's obviously the Oscar is the biggest kind of award that you can get in terms of world recognition. And it's almost like our American knighthood, you know, in a funny sort of way. but I think of it as, you know, as winning the lottery, because I'm not a film composer, basically. So I don't devote my work to film music. I've written 3 films, and, you know, like Copland, I think he's written about the same number. And basically, I write for the concert hall. So the award that, you know, recognizes my work as a serious composer is the Pulitzer. And that, therefore, for a composer, that's the one that means the most.
Could you talk a little bit about the music itself in The Red Violin? And we'll come back to the concert piece, perhaps, that you wrote out of the same material. That is a very haunting melody that sort of, it's almost a part in the movie. You can't listen to it without thinking of the Schindler's List theme of from John Williams's pen. What was it like to do that kind of work under those very different deadlines and pressures?
Well, actually, it's better to do that. I mean, as a composer, I think the thing that's the most daunting is a blank page and someone saying, write 20 minutes of music or 30 minutes of music. When anyone has restrictions that are imposed, be they arbitrary restrictions that some composers impose, like using a 12-tone method or a minimalist method or something of that nature, or it's a director saying, I need this amount of music to do this, and then I need this done there. The minute you're given restrictions, it becomes possible to have your imagination start to work. Until then, you either have to impose them or you have to start a piece from scratch cloth, which is what I do. That is, have no restrictions and then ask why I'm writing the piece. When I do that in concert music, it takes me months just to figure out what I want to do. Whereas in a film, I know exactly what I want to do because the director needs something and I'm to provide it. That doesn't mean that I'm not to please myself and write music of excellence, but it does mean I have a direction to go. And in this case, the direction was very clear, and the director was very clear, which made it easier for me.
You had a character to write for, too, in a very direct way. Does it force you to be, or did you need to be forced to be accessible in a movie way that you wouldn't have otherwise?
No, because my vocabulary, as far as I'm concerned, can go from this simple melodic material to highly dense chromatic material and various techniques that are aleatoric or cluster-like and sonoric rather than harmonic. And they're all in a palette that I think I could use. The problem with using them is when and where and how, and therefore when I build my concert music and architect it, I then provide the palette for the worlds I'll go into. But in this film, the world was very clear. It was a romantic story. It was a story that had a violin as the main character over 300 years in, you know, five different countries. But the thing also that was important was the violin theme had to be something that could be hummed by the wife of the violin maker to herself and then grow into the violin theme since it came out of her. So it had to be, therefore, something very singable.
Our phone is 617-450-2923. John Corigliano, the composer, is our guest. He won the Pulitzer Prize this week for his second symphony. This is the theme from the movie The Red Violin. Give him a call at 617-450-2923. Tom Lee is on the line, a composer. Thomas Oboe Lee, I should say. Welcome, Tom Lee.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I'm enjoying the show very much.
Well, thank you, Tom. We do it for you.
Well, anyway, I have a couple of remarks to make. Number one, congratulations to John Corigliano. I think having him win the Pulitzer Prize at this time, the beginning of the 21st century, is a very, very positive sign in terms of changing from music that's very academic and hard to digest for the general audience to a kind of music that people can actually enjoy and go home and have some kind of memory of it. It sort of brings to mind about, you know, why, for example, a lot of popular classical composers like John Adams, Philip Glass, Steve Reich have not gotten the Pulitzer Prize. So perhaps this is a good sign that they will be next in line.
Okay, I think that's great. I'm very grateful for the comment, and I do understand what you're talking about. I think that always, a prize is given by a panel, and if the panel changes, is in flux, then we have a healthy situation. And I think that that's been happening, and that's really going to make the big difference.
Right. And my second remark is with regard to the Academy. I have found so often that, you know, the professors are, you know, cranking out clones of themselves, of the so-called academic-type composers. But right now, I see a very healthy sign of younger composers who are taking over places like Princeton, for example, Steve Mackey, Michael Gandolfi at the New England Conservatory, Michael Dougherty at the University of Michigan. And I think the next generation of composers will be coming out who are going to be writing music that are very eclectic, that are very inclusive. And as you say yourself, you know, your palette is totally, you know, wide open. And I think this new generation of composers are of that ilk.
What's it going to be? Tom Lee, what's it going to sound like?
Pardon me?
What's that generation's music going to sound like? Is it going to be what we call the sort of new American romanticism?
No. I don't think there's going to be any kind of style. You know, I mean, what's his name? The Fromm Foundation guy. What's his first name? I'm just forgetting right now.
I don't know.
What? Pardon me?
Not Eric Fromm. That's another dude.
The Fromm Foundation at Tanglewood.
Yeah.
Anyway, he always believed in the kind of pluralism that's happening right now, and I think that's going to happen now. If you think about people like Golijov, you know, people like Tom Dune, the music is getting to be, you know, without borders, without international borders. And I think that's the kind of music that's going to be happening in the in this coming century.
John Corigliano, you want to comment?
I think he's absolutely right. I think that the healthiest thing that's happening isn't happening in this country right now. And some of Europe is still caught in the idea that there's one kind of music, the Boulezian idea that tonality is dead and that you must go on, the kind of dogmatic or fundamentalist approach. And I think that is an old-fashioned idea. And I think in this country, we've gone beyond that. And we're now at the stage where we can judge music for its intrinsic quality and not for whether it obeys certain rules. And I love the idea of these younger teachers in the school system, because I think that that's where the lifeblood is. And you can always tell. I've gone to many, many conservatories and schools. I'm about to go up to Hart College in about an hour to work with their students. You can always tell a healthy composition faculty if you have a master class with the students and all the pieces sound different. Then you know you're dealing with a department that does not enforce a kind of dogma. And I find that more and more in the school systems of the universities and conservatories. So I think you're absolutely right. A healthier time is happening here.
John Corigliano, I want to change of pace here. I'd like to sample something very, very different out of your work, the Etude Fantasy, performed by James Tocco, solo piano. I'd like to play the fifths and thirds section of it, a real virtuoso playing piece, but also enormously energetic piano writing. Could we listen? John Corigliano, can you play that piece yourself?
Oh, God, no. No, I'm actually not a trained pianist. My mother was a pianist, and I had about two lessons with her, and that was the end of that. I can play those notes, but not at that speed and not in that continuity. So I know it's pianistic because my hands played them all, but not the way James Tocco does.
What was the history of that piece, the conception of it? It has a jazz feel in many moments.
Well, that may be, but it's going to be like Copland's jazz of his later music. As Bernstein, I think, in fact, said to me, the most interesting jazz elements of Copland's music are not in his 1920s jazz pieces, but in his abstract music, where it has gotten into his body and has come out as Aaron Copland, infused by those rhythmic and harmonic ideas, and they come out in a more abstract way. So there was no thought of that in this. What happened here is that I was asked in the bicentennial year to write a piece for the Kennedy Center commissions for James Tocco, who is the brilliant pianist who recorded that, and they just said write a large-scale piano work. And I had heard Jimmy play for years, and I always admired him tremendously as a pianist. But one of the things that fascinated me is he played a left-hand etude, and I'm trying to remember the man's name who wrote it. It's a 19th century composer. It's before Wittgenstein commissioned all those left-hand pieces. This is way before that.
There's a Brahms setting of a Bach Chaconne for the left hand.
Yes, yes, I know that. It isn't that. Blumenthal, that's it, Felix mm-hmm. Blumenthal. Anyway, I heard it, and I was always amazed as a non-pianist, and the question came to me is, as a non-pianist, I'm a righty, so my right hand is better than my left. Why is it that left hand is the hand of choice, in a sense, if you're going to do an unaccompanied work? And so that became a little obsessive to me. I said, gee, I'd love to find out, and he's so good at that. But then I thought, I can't write a 20-minute piece for left hand with no relief. I mean, the Ravel concerto is for left hand, but there are orchestral tutti's where the pianist can shake his hand a little bit and get some blood back into it. But you can't really do that for 20 minutes. So then it became a shorter idea. And then I said, well, what would happen if that were the beginning of a series of etudes, and the material from this left hand etude, the first one, which is about 4.5 minutes long, that all the material for that became the generated material that would then become the material for the other etudes, the fifths, the thirds, and all the others that I was doing. So the genesis really had to do with the fascination of a problem. And the problem for me was to find out why the left hand was better. And indeed, while I was writing it, I found out, how much better it does work for certain sonority building, for melodic work, since the thumb is the top note, and therefore you can do strong melodic work, for the way that you can switch your fifth and first finger so that you can do arpeggiated work easily. I found that it was a great hand. Now, that's the opening, yes.
Yeah.
All left hand.
All left hand. Don't try this at home, listeners. This could be dangerous. But it made the point to you of the solo power of just the left hand at the piano. Let's listen, but also let's take a call, if you will. The phone is 617-450-2923. Anne is calling from Eugene, Oregon.
Hello.
Hello, Anne. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm enjoying the program a lot. I've liked John's music ever since we heard Symphony here in Eugene that he composed. And I have a question for him, because I actually am involved with a fairly large school of music with a huge composition program. Or at least it seems huge. We have about 50 young composers. And I wanted to ask him, especially in light of what Tom Lee said about the eclectic nature of composition going on now, and I find that true in our school. Our kids are writing all kinds of music, and it's a delight and a surprise to go to their concerts. But I wonder what you have to say to young composers about how they should find their voice amidst this. If there's one style, it's more easy, I think, to find out who you are in that style. When there's everything is open, I wonder how it is that a young composer can say, okay, this is my style, or this is what I want to pursue now.
What's your advice, John Corigliano? And what's your own experience of this question? I mean, who is John Corigliano? When did we discover him?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question, because for years, since I am eclectic and do use different techniques, I thought I had no style. And I think the interesting thing is that this was the personal style of a composer is actually something he's not aware of. He can use different techniques. 12-tone is just a technique. It's not a style. Different 12-tone composers sound differently. Minimalist techniques, aleatoric techniques. What is the style of a composer? And this was shown to me with this very piece, and in fact, this movement you're listening to right now, is the unconscious choices that a composer makes. There was a composer, Leonardo Ballada, who came to my house, and I told him I had no style, because I said, I want the world. I don't want to be inhibited by, or narrow vision of one world only that I can occupy. And he said, but of course you have a style. And he told me to get this Etude Fantasy out, and then to get Fantasia on an Ostinato, a piece I wrote for the Van Cliburn competition based on Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, the Second Movement, for two hands. And he showed me something that I was totally unaware of, and that was that one of the passages in the left-hand piece that had to do with the shifting of the first to the fifth finger and various things you can play because of that was duplicated exactly in the Beethoven, at the climax of the Beethoven Seventh Symphony piece, but one was derived from the left hand, and it was precisely the same notes, the exact same pitches, and one was derived from the Beethoven major-minor chain of chords that he had. And he said, you see, that's your style. It's like your handwriting. Your style is something that you don't know, but it's there, and in fact, someone who really knows your music can identify it very clearly.
But what, chosen... John, what did he say the signature was? Was it those minor third intervals?
Different things. You see, the thing about style, personal style, is those unconscious choices may be anything. They could be sonority choices. They could be gravitating towards a certain note. I find that many of my pieces begin and end on A. I never noticed that before. I find that certain spacings of chords are things I gravitate towards, certain worlds of rhythm, and I don't think about that. That's part of the composition process I don't think about. And those are the things that take you through a piece like Fern Hill that was written when I was 21 to a piece like The Etude Fantasy, say, that you're listening to now, which have totally different techniques involved. But techniques are not style. If you look at, for example, the 18th century and you say there are 18th century techniques like Alberti basses, but did Haydn sound like Mozart? No. Can you sometimes mistake them? Yes. But if you listen closely, you hear the choices that Mozart made versus the choices that Haydn made. And the same is true, say, with Bach and Handel. Sure, we can all learn various things that call Baroque style, you know, the motor rhythm, the terrace dynamics, this, that, and the other thing. But the signatures of those two people are very different.
Does John Corigliano sound like Bach? I'd like to play, again, a completely different sort of thing. Your Bach piece, inspired by the Goldberg Variations, performed by Yo-Yo Ma. Could we just play it? And I'd love you to explain the derivation of this one.
Now this piece has an endlessly long line. The point of this, and I was explaining it to Yo-Yo when he recorded it, is that the human breath can last just so long, but this line keeps going, and you'll notice it doesn't stop and doesn't stop, as a string player can do, and is still going with a single phrase. And based on the contour and the world of the Bach aria from the Goldberg Variations, actually its inspiration has to do with something in Boston, and that is a very wonderful family named the Goldbergs. And they asked me to write a piece to celebrate their anniversary. And they were very close to Yo-Yo Ma and Emmanuel Ax, and they said they would play it. And I suggested that instead of just writing one piece, since their name is Goldberg, why don't they ask a bunch of composers to write Goldberg variations on the Goldberg theme from the Bach? And they did that. And in the intervening time, tragically, and really quite tragically, Mr. Goldberg died, and of rather suddenly, of cancer. And this tribute to a wedding of great love was changed into a tribute of, you know, two people who loved each other very much and are not together. And so Judy Goldberg, who is still in Boston, had a concert at Jordan Hall, and the Bach Goldberg aria was played, and six composers' pieces were played that echoed that. And mine, I felt I wanted the sound of the cello alone. So mine was for unaccompanied cello, as you can hear. And It was a feeling for me of the endlessness of the love that they had, the fact that these phrases don't really end, they just continue. And so it became a memorial concert, but also a very beautiful tribute to a marvelous man and a wonderful woman and a marriage of great love. And I met the Goldbergs, I met Judy at the Symphony No. 2 concert. She's a friend of my family's. And we talked about it, and the record has just come out, so she got a chance to hear this performance on recording. As you can see, these phrases continue. Hmm. And there'll be a central section now, which speeds up a little bit, and then it'll return back to the very serene, endless chain of notes that represents to me that endless chain. Hmm.
Yo-Yo Ma heard your news of the Pulitzer on his way to Europe and tipped his hat, asked to be remembered to you with great admiration. John Corigliano, I've also heard that you're writing a musical in the Bernstein or perhaps the Sondheim tradition, or maybe some other tradition. Can you talk about it?
Well, I could if I were doing it, but at this point it's not happening yet, and I don't know if it will. The thing about collaborative art, like musicals, because I'm not my own librettist, is that we just have to have the right thing happen. And Bill Hoffman, who is the librettist of The Ghosts of Versailles, my opera, we both talked about a musical. He, in fact, is doing a musical with someone now, but not me, because one of the problems with writing musicals is they are not commissioned. And Bill has the rent and, you know, various things like, you know, getting money for dinner and laundry, just like every other living human being. And it's very difficult to spend a lot of his time working on a musical that at this particular moment could bring him no livelihood. So we've been putting it off till he is able to do that, because life marches on. And, you know, when I get a commission to write we got a commission to write an opera from the Met, for example. He got paid and I got paid and we did our work. But a musical doesn't work that way. You sort of have to work up a treatment of it. You audition it for people, you know.
You need an angel or two.
Yeah, we need some angels. So anyone who wants to give a couple of million, on the other hand, just give a ring.
Just say, you speak a lot about collaborators. Josh Bell is an important collaborator on the Red Violin. Yo-Yo, too, you mentioned Bill Hoffman. What does that tell us? Is that usual among today's musicians?
Well, I think it's usual amongst today's composers that are trying to live in the music world that exists outside, yes. I mean, an electronic composer does not need to collaborate. It's a completely self-encapsulated art. But if you deal with performers, collaboration is a real part of the art, because basically, for example, when, you know, the Brahms Violin Concerto is being played by Itzhak Perlman, we are hearing two things happening. We're hearing a piece that exists that we all know by Brahms, and then we're hearing what Itzhak Perlman has done to make it different, to change it, to make it his own, and yet keep the Brahms quality in it. So collaborative art is always, any symphonic performing art is collaborative art. Mm. And so anybody who deals with that must deal with it. And I try to offer my collaborators certain freedoms. There was a tradition in music, and Stravinsky was one of the people who said, don't interpret my music, just play it. And there was a time where you could actually notate the performer out of a piece. So the performer became a performing instrument that simply looked at the music and did everything that was said. But I tend to think of the music page as a blueprint upon which the performance is built. But it has to be a very detailed blueprint. But if it's overly detailed, and if everything is spelled out and there's no room for the performer, I think the lifeblood of the creative art and the performing art don't mix together and it come out, and we lose something in the process.
John Corigliano, I was struck again by blueprint. I wanted to ask you, there's so many architecture references in your conversation, arch references in your music, but we'll do that the next time. I think we're going to go out on more of the music of your second symphony, with great thanks and best wishes, and I must say great anticipation about the work ahead. John Corigliano, thank you enormously for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
John Corigliano, who won the Pulitzer Prize this week for music, and very specifically for this second symphony, a string symphony commissioned by the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Thank you, John Corigliano. Thanks, Tom Lee. Thanks also to New England Streaming Media for live audio streaming. And thanks to the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. Our program was produced in the BMP studios at the Christian Science Monitor by the team of Dan First, Jeff Turton, Noel Flatt, Jake Shapiro, Hitesh Hatti, Amy McDonald, and Catherine Bidwell. Mary McGrath is our senior producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you.